to Dominic Cummings. Parts of this chapter originally appeared in the author's Times Literary Supplement review of Protest and Power, The Battle for the Labour Party by David Cogan. Chapter 8, Dominic Cummings. A basic problem for people in politics is that approximately none have the hard skills necessary to distinguish great people from charlatans. Dominic Cummings. On the 9th of June 2017, the former director of Vote Leave, Dominic Cummings, shambled onto the stage at Nudgestock, an annual festival that bills itself as the UK's largest gathering of behavioural sciences experts. He was there to deliver a speech entitled Why Leave Won the Referendum. Listening to it now, it is easy to understand why a rare in-person public speech from a man widely credited with masterminding the Vote Leave operation garnered so little attention at the time. Cummings appears deliberately obtuse, and most of the print media was still reeling from the shock of the referendum result, with the BBC particularly hidebound by instructions from on high to focus on the result itself, rather than asking questions about its validity or the methods behind it. Channel 4 News did its best to reflect its significance, but it was ploughing a lonely furrow. It was during this period that Robbie Gibb, the BBC's director of live political programmes, who became Theresa May's director of communications a month later, instructed the corporation's editor Rob Burley not to interrogate the infamous claim on the side of a bus that leaving the European Union would somehow enable £350 million a week to be spent on the NHS. Summer 2015. I was sitting at home, happily unemployed, in the garden, having a beer, reading, Cummings told the audience, and I started to get phone calls. The election had just happened a couple of days earlier. Cameron had unexpectedly won, and I started to get phone calls from a few MPs and some campaigners and a few Tory party donor billionaires, saying essentially, well, this referendum is now going to happen, but no one's actually prepared anything for it. No one's built anything. There's no campaign. What are you doing? Can you come and help? Can you create something that could actually fight it? Leaving aside, for now, the irony of billionaire donors trying to enlist an unelected bureaucrat for a campaign that would profess to be anti-establishment and effectively cast people in both categories as enemies of their Brexit. Instead, consider both why Cummings was unemployed and why his phone started trilling on that May evening. For many outside Westminster, Cummings was largely unknown before he accepted those invitations to set up a Leave campaign. Inside Westminster, however, he was seen as a formidable, unstable force who could sway voters and deliver the results billionaire donors desired. But why they put their faith in him is as fascinating as it is unknown. Indeed, for all his carefully contrived attempts to appear an outsider or a maverick, the Cummings backstory could hardly tick more how they broke Britain boxes. Mysterious Russian connections, hard-right think tanks, roles in the Tory high command, and a pronounced cosiness with right-wing media. His father-in-law is, like David Cameron's, a baronet, and his wife, Mary Wakefield, an editor at Andrew Neil's Spectator. After graduating from Oxford in 1994, Cummings moved to Russia to work for a group hoping to set up an airline. These past activities came to new light in November 2019, when Cummings was Prime Minister Boris Johnson's most senior adviser. The Sunday Times reported that a whistleblower has approached senior Labour politicians to raise questions about the relationships that Boris Johnson's chief of staff, Cummings, may have developed with people involved in politics, intelligence and security when he worked in Russia between 1994 and 1997. The Shadow Foreign Secretary, Emily Thornberry, wrote to her opposite number, Dominic Raab, to ask whether Cummings's past raised concerns about him being granted access to the highest levels of classified material, or given such high levels of influence over UK government policy. A message copied in the Cabinet Secretary and National Security Advisor, as well as the heads of MI5 and MI6. As far as I'm aware, Cummings has never responded to these claims. Thornberry's concerns coincided with widespread worries that the so-called Russia Report, the Intelligence and Security Committee's ISC, investigation into allegations of Russian interference in British politics would not be published before the general election scheduled for the 12th of December 2019. The committee had completed the report in March, and, after undergoing redaction by security and intelligence agencies, it was delivered to Johnson on the 17th of October. But he refused to then make it public. On the failure to publish, the Conservative chair of the ISC, Dominic Grieve MP, said, "What has absolutely astonished me is the mendacity of the response from the Number 10 press office, which I do take to be linked to Cummings. They have come up with a series of utterly bogus explanations why it can't be published now, and they really are whopping lies." These are remarkably strong words for a former Attorney General, a role that historically had been reserved for parliamentarians with impressive legal backgrounds, although this precedent would be abandoned when Boris Johnson appointed Suella Braverman to the position in February 2020. Grieve's reservations proved well-founded. Johnson cleared the report for publication the day after securing an 80-seat majority in the December 2019 election. It was finally published in July 2020 and was, by any account, damning. Vladimir Putin's administration had been engaged in hostile foreign interference, and Russia was identified as a significant threat on a number of fronts, from espionage to interference in democratic process and to serious crime. In a distinct echo of the Brexit purdah imposed at the BBC and the police failure to investigate Vote Leave, the report criticised the illogical approach by MI5 not to fully investigate how much Moscow had tried to influence the referendum due to extreme caution about being seen to interfere in democratic processes. Committee member Stuart Hosey, MP, told a news conference that ministers did not want to know and actively avoided looking for evidence. The government's official response, "We have seen no evidence of successful interference in the EU referendum," rather ignored the fact that they had, apparently, quite deliberately, not looked for any. As Dominic Grieve would tell the BBC, "When the committee came to ask the question, 'Can you tell us there wasn't interference?' we really weren't able to get an answer." Once again, we can only wonder what the UK media would have done with both of these stories if the individuals under suspicion had been perceived as unsympathetic to their shared cause. But to return our focus back to Cummings in the mid-1990s, after the Russian airline plan proved spectacularly unsuccessful, Cummings returned to the UK in 1997. 2 years later, he started publicly cutting his Eurosceptic teeth as campaign director of Business for Britain. Its mission to oppose the UK changing its currency to the euro was rendered redundant after Gordon Brown prevailed over Tony Blair and ruled it out completely. Cummings, who often insists that he is not a Conservative, then went to work as Director of Strategy for the Conservative leader, Ian Duncan Smith. He lasted 8 months, and in what would become a familiar refrain throughout his subsequent career, quit in protest at his colleagues' perceived failings, describing Smith as incompetent and potentially a worse Prime Minister than Tony Blair. Next, in a move echoed by much of the cast of this book, it was time for a senior role in a free market think tank. Cummings had sufficient connections, despite professing to be anti-establishment, that he merited one all of his own. In December 2003, he became the founding director of the New Frontiers Foundation. His campaign director at NFF was James Frayne, formerly of the Taxpayers Alliance, now director of policy and strategy at the Policy Exchange think tank. The chairman was Lord Salisbury, a former Tory leader in the Lords. Given what transpired long after their initial association, it is interesting to see how Salisbury regarded Cummings's referendum tactics when writing to Theresa May in April 2019 to complain about her Brexit negotiations and inform her that his stately home, Hatfield House, would no longer be made available for Conservative Party functions. "I am not naive enough to believe that leaving would not be painful," he wrote. "It clearly would be, and I thought the Leave campaign was most unwise not to say so." The New Frontiers Foundation barely lasted a year, and I have been unable to establish who funded it, but its advisory council contained some interesting names. Stuart Wheeler is the Eton-educated spread-betting magnate and former Tory donor who would become treasurer of UKIP in 2011. Stanley, now Baron Calmes, the head of the electrical retailer Currys, had just stepped down as treasurer of the Tory party and spent 10 years from 1991 as director of the Centre for Policy Studies. Another member, Niall Gardiner, is today a director of the Margaret Thatcher Centre for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation think tank in Washington, D.C., a regular contributor to Fox News and the Daily Telegraph's go-to correspondent for hatchet jobs on Joe Biden. Recent highlights include Here Comes Biden, the World's Worst Diplomat, 8th of July 2023. Joe Biden helped cause this global downturn. He's in no position to lecture Truss, 18th of October 2022. And in an all-too-rare foray into British political analysis, Liz Truss can be a powerful leader of the free world, 28th of August 2022. At least one element of the short-lived New Frontiers Foundation's lean output seems significant. In 2004, it described the BBC as the mortal enemy of the Conservative Party and called for the end of the BBC in its current form. Given that the NFF only boasted two staff members and that Cummings would later become a prolific blogger, it seems fair to assume that he was at the very least partly responsible for encouraging the development of the web networks scrutinising the BBC and providing information to commercial rivals with an interest in undermining the BBC's credibility. Furthermore, the NFF argued that the Conservatives can only prosper in the long term by undermining the BBC's reputation for impartiality in the way CBS's reputation is being undermined now, and by changing the law on political advertising. In September 2004, another blog post stated, "There are three structural things that the right needs to happen in terms of communications. One, the undermining of the BBC's credibility. Two, the creation of a Fox News equivalent, stroke talk radio shows, stroke bloggers, etc. to shift the centre of gravity. Three, the end of the ban on TV political advertising." It was also suggested that government ministers should avoid appearing on BBC Radio 4's Today programme, as indeed they did after Cummings entered Downing Street. It is already clear that, far from being the genius outlier of his own mythology, Dominic Cummings is every bit as embedded in the ecosystem of cronyism and manipulation as anyone else in this book. The only almost endearing difference is that he seems to despise almost everybody else in it. Nevertheless, as we shall shortly see, his feelings didn't prevent him from going to work for Andrew Neil, or his most abiding contribution to national politics from being achieved in partnership with Matthew Elliott. First, though, I want to tilt at the genius element of his self-styled reputation, as opposed to the maverick, with compelling evidence that some of the strategies he deployed when running Vote Leave were simply reheated manipulations. In 2004, shortly before the failure of the New Frontiers Foundation, Cummings popped up in his native Northeast as a strategic advisor to NESNO, the Northeast Says No campaign against regional devolution. It is largely forgotten now, but Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott's plans for regional assemblies were initially very popular. In many ways, his dream of shifting the balance of power in the UK away from Westminster should have found favour with the sort of people that Cummings specialises in manipulating. In the event, the North East England devolution referendum turned out to be a dry run for the Brexit referendum because, rather than merely demonising out-of-touch London-based politicians, Cummings and his colleagues framed their cause as anti-politics itself. "The messaging was all about being the cheeky upstarts," recalls Graham Robb, the campaign's chief spokesman. "We were the insurgents. It was the anti-politics approach. It was the first time that approach had been taken." In addition to attacking politicians in general, three more elements of the campaign stand out: an eye-catching gimmick, nonsensical claims about NHS funding, and relentless, unapologetically vicious attacks on the opposition. "We did not need a positive message," wrote William Norton, NESNO's referendum agent. "We were the no campaign. That's a negative act." An enormous, inflatable white elephant proved the most memorable contributor to the referendum campaigns. Emblazoned with the slogan, "Vote no to a regional assembly, it's a white elephant," it captured the anti-politics sentiment perfectly. And alongside the Cummings-coined catchphrase, "Politicians talk, we pay," it helped to deliver a stunning turnaround at the ballot box, with 78% voting no. It also marked the first time that Cummings had been part of a campaign that owed its success to telling fibs about NHS funding. It would not be the last. "The regional assembly would create more politicians, so as you would expect, it means the regional assembly will come with huge extra cost," intoned Graham Robb in a film that was broadcast on regional television in the Northeast during the run-up to the vote. "The bill for the North East would be a staggering £1 million per week." Crucially, the caption, "More doctors, not politicians," appeared on the screen. The difficulty of debunking seductive disinformation, of fighting feelings and falsehoods with facts, would prove all too familiar to Remain campaigners 12 years later. But at the time of this devolution referendum, it was articulated particularly well by Julie Elliott, Sunderland Central MP and a prominent Yes campaigner. It was ludicrous to suggest that any additional money spent on a regional assembly could instead have been used to fund more doctors, she said. Local governments do not have extensive responsibility for medical services. But the problem was that once that disinformation was out there, it was impossible to extinguish it in many voters' minds. Prescott insisted that regional government would actually cost £12 million less to the people in the North East. But it didn't matter. People voted to reject the political establishment and to secure more money for the NHS. And where the inflatable elephant led, a bus would one day follow. As Cummings blogged in March 2019, it was a training exercise that turned out surprisingly well. SW1 100% ignored it, thankfully. I would like to make a small personal confession at this point. Of all the characters featured in this book, Cummings is the one I find most interesting, and even, much to my own surprise, often the one to whom I am most sympathetic. He is clearly as mad as a box of frogs, but I think he is driven by demons rather than defined by them, and although he carries a considerable sense of entitlement, it is at least based upon his largely justified opinion of his own intelligence relative to most of the people around him, rather than any form of birthright. Profilers make much of an unlikely period spent working at his uncle's notorious Durham nightclub Clute, and he certainly has never shown himself to be motivated by measurable personal advancement. This last point alone makes him almost unique in public life today, never mind in the circles he seems to have moved in since returning from Russia. Perhaps the most interesting element of his CV concerns the period immediately after the Nesno referendum when he proceeded to spend 2.5 years in a bunker he and his father built for him on their farm in Durham, reading science and history and trying to understand the world. Make no mistake, Cummings's contribution to the breaking of Britain is immense. As if the reality of Brexit were not bad enough, he also steered Boris Johnson to the 80-seat majority that he would use to smash up the last vestiges of parliamentary democracy and political integrity. Tragically, as nobody appreciates more than Cummings, it also meant that Johnson was in charge when COVID-19 came calling. And the Barnard Castle affair surely did untold damage to lockdown observance and what remained of the government's authority. But unlike the rest of the key architects of our national malaise, I think Cummings acted throughout with something close to good intentions. Researching this chapter, I have been reminded repeatedly of a cross-country runner, solitary, preternaturally committed, clear-eyed, contemptuous of distraction and competition alike, but, ultimately, unable ever to stop and wonder whether he might be running in the wrong direction entirely. I reserve the right to regret these words, but Dominic Cummings, however deluded or deranged he may have become in trying to deliver them, seems to have always acted in pursuit of what he genuinely believed to be the best interests of the country. It makes him the polar opposite of a Boris Johnson or a Nigel Farage, and of no use whatsoever to a Dacre or a Murdoch. An oddly solipsistic ideologue, there were times during the Brexit campaign when he seemed to hold some of the people on his own side in even lower regard than his opponents. His personal manifesto, for want of a better word, required existing structures from the civil service to ministerial government to be raised so that something superior could be built in its place. Understand this, and his willingness to break rules, laws, and untold conventions in pursuit of victory becomes understandable, if no less unforgivable. Neither would he be of much use to an Andrew Neil, as it turned out. In 2006, Cummings emerged from his bunker to take a job running the Spectator's embryonic website. It was a short-lived adventure. In early February, he uploaded a controversial cartoon of the Muslim prophet Muhammad with a bomb fuse-ignited in his turban. The Guardian reported that the magazine's acting editor, Stuart Reed, said he had not been responsible for uploading the picture, but after a call from Spectator publisher Andrew Neil, he gave instructions for the image to be taken down. He said the website did not have an editor, but the guy who has overall responsibility was Dominic Cummings. The text accompanying the cartoon, originally published in Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten, rather makes one wonder where Cummings would have ended up if he had not found an outlet for his energies in Westminster. European newspapers reprint Mohammed bomb turban cartoon, but as European populations die and Muslim populations grow, and as more and more European students are taught Foucault and literary critical theory, the balance of power shifts every day. Meanwhile, Britain's comic political class cannot even control Islamic terrorists when they finally lock a few up in prison. After the Spectator incident, Cummings began a 7-year stint as an advisor to Michael Gove, beginning in 2007 and spent in both opposition and government, where he ignited many more workplace fireworks and attracted decidedly mixed reviews from media and colleagues. Apart from cementing his deep loathing of the civil service and most politicians, the period is only tangentially pertinent to the broader project here. There was a brief hiccup to his progress when Andy Coulson, for reasons unknown, sought to keep him out of government, but once there, he made no secret of his loathing for the Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg. David Cameron was widely presumed to be describing Cummings when he mentioned a career psychopath in a speech to a policy exchange garden party in 2014, and Clegg himself is on the record as calling him some loopy individual who used to be a sort of backroom advisor. Some thoughts on education and political priorities. A very long essay, it runs to 237 pages, written in 2013, provides a helpful insight into how Cummings found himself happily unemployed in summer 2015. As special advisor to the Secretary of State of Education, the scale of his ambition for British school leaders was immense. "We need leaders with an understanding of Thucydides and statistical modelling," he wrote, "who have read The Brothers Karamazov and The Quark and the Jaguar, who can feel Kipling's Kim and succeed in Tetlock's Good Judgment Project." But even in Michael Gove's Department of Education, the ambition of delivering an Odyssean education so that a substantial fraction of teenagers, students and adults might understand something of our biggest intellectual and practical problems and be trained to take effective action was surely unrealistic. This disconnect between his ambitions and the reality of what is possible is significant for three reasons. It signals the first depiction of the civil service as the blob, resisting reform and allergic to change. It enforces his belief that meaningful improvement necessitates the destruction of the status quo, and it puts him intriguingly at odds with his professed political hero, Otto von Bismarck, who maintained that politics is the art of the possible, the attainable, the art of the next best. It is hard to think of an attitude more diametrically opposed to the one that Cummings, who quit the department in early 2014, would take to vote leave. There are, then, three key constituents to the Cummings conundrum. First, his contempt for pretty much everybody. This is obvious and born of a belief that his prescription is the only cure for any given ill. In the context of short-term, achievable goals like referendums, this is more strength than weakness. In the context of long, incremental missions, such as rewriting education policy or even governing, it is a monumental flaw. Realising his dreams in Downing Street, for example, would have involved being able to control Boris Johnson for years. Johnson, as anybody with any experience of his personal, professional and political activities had known for decades, is at best a capricious egotist, at worst a sociopathic narcissist. It is, in retrospect, almost impossible to understand how Cummings thought he might exercise Rasputin-like influence over a man interested exclusively in his own immediate gratification. As he would tell the joint hearing of the Science and Technology Committee and Health and Social Care Committee of the House of Commons in May 2021, "It doesn't matter if you've got great people doing communications if the PM changes his mind 10 times a day and then calls up the media and contradicts his own policy day after day after day. You're going to have a communications disaster zone," adding, "Nobody could find a way around the problem of the Prime Minister, who was just like a shopping trolley smashing from one side of the aisle to the other." Second, his conviction that anything is acceptable in pursuit of victory, that the end justified any means. This is defined by his belief in the unquestionable importance of that victory, and therefore leaves him conveniently immune to any moral or ethical qualms. Again, this seems more suited to snappy, single-issue movements than to drawn-out projects where scrutiny and accountability, however unappealing, are unavoidable. Finally, and most remarkably, he is not interested in personal enrichment, advancement, or status. This is why he finds it so easy to walk away from the fray, and I think why he so often seems almost detached from humanity itself. If everything is a model or part of a wider ideological project, then everybody is a spot on a graph or an algorithmic input. People are reduced to mere data, their lives important only insofar as they indicate voting intentions and susceptibility to manipulation. And again, you can get people to do what you want in the short term by deploying this approach, but it is less helpful answering the question of what happens after. This is why his seniority in Downing Street at the start of the COVID-19 outbreak would prove so problematic, something that, as we shall see, he seemed eventually to acknowledge himself. On the 20th of April 2016, an appearance before the Treasury Committee saw these attributes on startling display. Cummings was there to account for some of the claims being made by Vote Leave. The chair, Conservative Andrew Tyrie, is by turns bewildered and enraged by his testimony. In retrospect, it feels like a much more significant moment than was acknowledged at the time. It is essentially a clash of political culture, with Tyrie and most of his colleagues clinging to the notion that you can't simply make stuff up to suit your aims, and Cummings condescendingly certain that you absolutely can. Nowhere is this clash, or Tyrie's incredulity, more evident than in an early exchange over the relevance of the actual numbers used by Cummings in campaign literature. In this case, the claim that EU regulation costs the UK £33.3 billion per year. Tyrie, what you are saying is that there are a range of numbers. We should not take any particular number that you are using as a headline number, and you are using the £600 million per week and £33.3 billion per annum cost of regulation all the time in your literature, and you are now telling us in evidence that we should set that at a heavy discount and not worry about it or its accuracy too much because it is just one of a range of numbers that may be taken into consideration. Is that summary of your evidence right? Cummings, roughly speaking, what you are saying is a reasonable perspective. As I said, campaigns on both sides and the government produce these economic studies that have various numbers. It is crazy for anyone to take decimal points seriously in these things. Tyrie, this is a decimal point that is moving along quite a long way, is it not? We're talking about a decimal point that has shifted quite a bit from £33 billion to £13 billion at the stroke. The contents may be a little turgid, but this reveals much about how Cummings thinks and operates. Another exchange, in which Cummings seeks to somehow negate the £6 billion rebate Margaret Thatcher negotiated on the UK's annual contribution to the EU budget, begins in remarkable fashion. Tyrie, do you know how much the rebate is? Cummings, the rebate is £3 billion or £4 billion. Tyrie, it is £6 billion. Are you aware of what happens to the rebate physically? Cummings, yes. Tyrie, perhaps you would like to describe that to the committee. Cummings, the interesting thing about the rebate is... Tyrie's point is to demonstrate that after the agreed rebate, the UK's annual contribution to the EU stands at £13 billion per annum and not the £19 billion figure used for all Vote Leave's calculations, including the £350 million on the side of the infamous bus. Not only that, but the same money has apparently been earmarked for sundry other destinations. It reminds me of a young child asking, in all seriousness, to spend their birthday money again. Tyrie, I am just asking you why you are suggesting in some of your literature that you might allocate all of that to extra spending on hospitals. As an organisation, you are proposing that. Cummings, as an organisation, we are saying that once we stop the £19.1 billion debit, then we will have roughly £350 million per week to spend on our priorities, like the NHS. The NHS is the country's top priority and is a fairly obvious target for where a lot of these savings would be spent. Tyrie, I'm asking you the same question for a third time. You have made it clear that there are a number of other priorities that you personally may want to spend money on, such as science, and you have agreed that a number of other groups are going to get financial protection. Why have you nonetheless persisted with the idea that this same pot can be raided and used exclusively for the NHS? That is what I am asking you. Cummings, we are not. Tyree, I have here one of your posters, which is available, and you are encouraging your supporters to download. It gives a clear enough message to any reasonable persons that is telling you that we should give the whole of this £350 million per week to the NHS, does it not? And finally, in the section that follows, note the supreme casualness with which Cummings approaches the question of precisely what information his organisation is putting in the hands of public and how. His only colleague at that short-lived think tank, Tufton Street veteran James Frayne, wrote in 2013 that messages that touch people on an emotional level cause a physical reaction in the brain that makes such messages more likely to be stored in our long-term memory and therefore more likely to affect our political outlook. By 2016, Cummings seemed not to care how you get those messages there, or indeed whether or not they are even true. Tyree, I just want to touch on one more point. You are saying in your literature, in hospitals, that we can give a lot more money to hospitals. Are you not? You are distributing literature to that effect. You are doing that. Are you not? Cummings, no, we are not. We have not distributed any literature whatsoever to hospitals. Tyree, I have a piece of literature here with your logo. Is this a pirated piece of literature? It says, vote leave, take control. It is badged as your literature. It says, help protect your local hospital. It has, here at the bottom, voteleavetakecontrol.org. Is that not your organisation? Cummings, it looks like it is one of our leaflets, yes. Tyree, so you are distributing these things to hospitals. This was picked up from Guy's Hospital. Cummings, I saw that story, I think, on a website. Tyree, I have one of the leaflets here. Yes. Cummings, yes, I saw that story on the website last week. We do not have a clue where that has come from. It certainly was not done by us. Tyree, so is this pirated? Cummings, no. Well, I have no idea. I very much doubt it. Tyree, I just want clarity. Cummings, I am giving you clarity. Tyree, you have not yet on many of the points that I have been asking. Let me go through some very simple questions. Did your organisation print this leaflet? Cummings, it looks likely that we did, but I cannot tell about any individual leaflet. Tyree, you do not know which leaflets might be printed by your organisation. You are running a campaign and do not know, Cummings, you are misunderstanding what I am saying. Tyree, I do not think you are understanding the question. I am asking a straightforward and simple question. We are getting down to very simple questions. Is this a leaflet of your organisation? Cummings, do you mean that design of leaflet or that individual leaflet? Tyree, I am asking you if this leaflet is one of your organisation's leaflets. Cummings, yes, it is. Tyree, good. We have answered question one. Now let us try question two. Is it reasonable that somebody might misconstrue this leaflet at first glance as a leaflet produced by the NHS since it has an NHS logo in the top right-hand corner? Cummings, no, it says vote leave, take control at the bottom with our logo. Tyree, what do you make of the NHS logo there? Cummings, what do you mean what do I make of it? Tyree, does it look like the logo of the NHS? Cummings, it looks roughly like it from here. Tyree, it looks roughly like it from almost any distance. Here is an NHS document encouraging you to eat better food, and you will see that the logo is strikingly similar. They are, in fact, almost identical. It takes an expert eye to tell that the one is not the other. One of them is slightly italicised, the other is not. Now that you have had a chance to consider whether you did in fact produce this leaflet and you have agreed that it does look like an NHS leaflet at any reasonable distance, do you think it might be a good idea to think twice about putting out literature as misleading as this? Cummings, no, I certainly do not, and you are confused about what my answer was before. I thought you were asking me if the leaflet you were holding in your hand had been put into a hospital and had come from us, and I was saying no, it has not come from us, as in we did not distribute leaflets to the hospital. We are as baffled as everybody else about the story that appeared on the website. That has not happened because of us or at my direction. Nobody in the office knows why it has happened. That is what I was saying. If you are saying you have one of the leaflets from that hospital, and you are holding it up in front of me asking, is this yours? My answer is, it looks like something that we have printed, but it is certainly not something that we have put into Guy's Hospital. It doesn't matter now, of course, but the fact that it didn't even matter then is another mark of how deeply the discourse had been corrupted, to allow these levels of disingenuousness and deceit to go unchecked. Incidentally, there were two Tory Brexiters on the committee, Jacob Rees-Mogg and hard man of Brexit Steve Baker. One sketch writer encapsulated their contributions. They did their best to tee their man up with a few easy questions, much like members of a parole board trying to find some good in a prisoner who has managed for the first time to get through an entire group therapy session without assaulting anyone. But Cummings was much too far gone. With Brexit, two of the three key Cummings characteristics, the unshakable beliefs that his prescription is the only cure and that the end justifies any means, would collide in catastrophic fashion. We have explored at length why, by 2016, the UK media was utterly ill-equipped to report the facts of the referendum with even a modicum of objectivity or accuracy. False equivalents, epic proprietorial and editorial biases, a cowed BBC, emotional appeals to nativist bigotries, and the weaponized populist ignorance of many pro-Leave politicians saw to that. Factor in the insipid Remain campaign and the pathetic contributions of Cameron and Corbyn, the first accidentally, the second deliberately, and you have an almost perfect recipe for the disaster that has followed. The final, essential ingredient, however, was not added in public. It was added in the privacy of their computers and smartphones. For all the talk of the will of the people and the 17.4 million Leave voters, Cummings implicitly understood what was needed to tilt the scales. He defined it as about 600,000 people, just over 1% of registered voters. To fully understand their significance and how completely they were misinformed, we must go back to his appearance at Nudstock that opened this chapter. The speech was delivered the day after Theresa May's embarrassment in the 2017 general election. Assured by advisers like Nick Timothy, her joint chief of staff, that she would enhance her fragile majority by going to the polls, she ended up losing that majority and was forced into a supply and demand arrangement with the Democratic Unionist Party, DUP. She would be toast within 2 years, while Timothy would inevitably end up writing hysterical columns for the Daily Telegraph, including "Britain's passive surrender to a woke minority risks everything we cherish," 9th of July 2023, and "A crisis of masculinity imperils the foundations of the West," 30th of April 2023. At the end of July 2023, he was selected to fight Matt Hancock's old seat at the next general election. It is hard to think of a finer example of Conservative Party members being forced to reward failure in order to continue denying they have helped usher in disaster. At Nudstock, Cummings, comfortable on stage and wearing a shirt that looked almost ironed, could not resist a quick dig. "I think what's happened in the last 24 hours with the election and the Tory party campaign," he said, "is another good example of how hard it has been for the bubble in SW1 to actually get to grips with what the effects of the financial crisis in 2008 were." Listing the key concerns underpinning a Brexit vote, he also cited immigration, obviously, and somewhat less convincingly, the euro. He claimed that seeing Greece literally on fire on TV screens had hardened anti-EU sentiment, despite the fact that there was, by 2016, no appetite anywhere for the UK to join the single currency. The speech gets really interesting about 13 minutes in, although his language is so opaque that the audience could be forgiven for not noticing. I am conscious of repeating myself when stressing that there is no point trying to relitigate Brexit today, however decisive the polls demonstrating Leave voters' regret or a desire to rejoin may be. Yet to understand how lies, prejudices and delusions could, in various combinations, come completely to dominate the governments of Johnson, Truss and Sunak, it is absolutely essential to understand how they were used to deliver the Brexit that started the wrecking ball rolling. "We had to take risks and we had to do things in a slightly new way," said Cummings. "One of the basic things that I did was I brought in a team of physicists who essentially looked at campaigning from complete first principles." Sounds reasonable, right? Even clever. Physicists deal in scientific facts, after all. In fact, these physicists were data scientists working for Aggregate IQ, AIQ, the obscure Canadian web analytics company based above a shop in Victoria, British Columbia, which featured in Shamir Sani's disclosures about B-Leave's finances, covered in Chapter 4. The indefatigable and supremely courageous Observer journalist, Carol Cadwallader, unravelled the web in which AIQ sits almost single-handedly from 2017 onwards, For this and her wider work exposing what would become known as the Facebook Cambridge Analytica data scandal, she has won enough awards to fill several mantelpieces. In the corrupted British ecosystem under scrutiny here, however, she is a regular target of the right-wing media. From the salaried trolls at the Guido Fawkes blog to Andrew Neil, who, despite being supposedly bound by BBC impartiality requirements, called her Carol Codswallop and a mad catwoman during one of his late-night Twitter rants in November 2018. He has never apologised. Carol's broader mission to expose the links between AIQ and Cambridge Analytica, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, and another secretive hedge fund manager called Robert Mercer remain riveting, deeply troubling, and criminally underreported. I urge you to read further into Carol's quest, but for our purposes here, it is Dominic Cummings's AIQ physicists who merit most attention. Cummings continued in his speech, "They, the physicists, also constructed models to help direct resources for the ground campaign and the digital campaign. Essentially, you had streams of data coming in from all sorts of different ways. The website, email on the ground, canvassing, social media, blah, blah, blah. All of this stuff coming in. And you had the data science people sitting at the heart of the operation and essentially taking our core messages and just running experimentally a whole bunch of things on Facebook and elsewhere and figuring out what things work and what things don't work." Cummings is in fact describing data mining. In the US in December 2022, Facebook's owner, Meta Platforms Inc., agreed to pay $725 million to resolve a class action lawsuit accusing them of allowing third parties, including Cambridge Analytica, to access users' personal information. Reuters reported that the proposed settlement would resolve a long-running lawsuit prompted by revelations in 2018 that Facebook had allowed the British political consulting firm Cambridge Analytica to access data of as many as 87 million users. In the light of what Dominic Cummings said next at Nudgestock about how his campaign identified Facebook users most likely to respond to its advertising, it remains remarkable that no similar investigation has been conducted in the UK. "You can define the demographics that you interrogate yourself," he said. "And what we did was we basically used the exact same categories for demographics that Facebook uses for its digital advertising platform. So we sucked in data on the precise same basis that Facebook marketing allows, and then we had therefore large subsamples of the overall polling samples that you could actually rely on. And then you could take that data and plug it straight back into Facebook, so you could say, for example, that we would target women between 35 and 45 who live in these particular geographical entities who don't have a degree. Finding persuadable voters is key for any campaign," wrote Carol Cadwallader in 2017. "And with its treasure trove of data, Cambridge Analytica could target people high in neuroticism, for example, with images of immigrants swamping the country. The key is finding emotional triggers for each individual voter." Cummings continued, "We basically dumped our entire budget in the last 10 days, and really in the last 3 or 4 days, and we aimed it at, I can't remember exactly, but roughly about 7 million people saw something like 1.5 billion digital ads over a relatively short period of time." In total, Vote Leave spent £3.9 million, more than half its official £7 million campaign budget, with Aggregate IQ. Three other affiliated Leave campaigns, BLeave, Veterans for Britain, and the Democratic Unionist Party, spent a further £757,750. So, what was in the carefully targeted advertisements on which Dominic Cummings spent most of Vote Leave's budget and remains convinced were absolutely crucial to its referendum success? It would be over a year before anyone except their recipients would know. On the 19th of July 2018, Rebecca Stimson, Facebook's UK head of policy, wrote to Damian Collins, the chair of the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Committee. "Your original question was, can we see copies of adverts from AIQ? Who were these adverts shown to? Who paid for them? We have previously answered the third part of this question as to who paid for these ads, and we explained that we were in the process of identifying and compiling the ads. We have now completed that process and enclose a copy of the ads run for the following Facebook pages by AIQ: Vote Leave, BLeave, Brexit Central, DUP, Vote to Leave." There are literally pages of them, but a few stand out. Turkey has a 511-mile border with Syria. Turkey is joining the EU. Good news? Question mark, question mark, question mark. Facebook users are invited to click on yes or no. The same invitation accompanies another ad. Turkey has a population of 76 million. Turkey is joining the EU. Good idea? Another features a photograph of a mother holding her newborn baby and smiling at the camera. A large shop door-style closed sign dominates half of the page. The text reads, "Imagine if we could keep our maternity units open because we weren't sending £350 million a week to the EU." Again, recipients are invited to click on the page, in this case on a bright red Save Maternity Units button. Another bizarrely insists that the European Union wants to kill our cuppa and features a clenched fist in the colours of the EU flag heading towards a cup of tea adorned with British iconography including a Routemaster bus, a red phone box and Big Ben. Another oddity insists that the EU blocks our ability to speak out and protect polar bears. It features a cute photograph of an adult polar shielding two cubs. It is not hard to imagine the effect that a veritable avalanche of these ads might have upon a Facebook user already identified by the algorithm as susceptible to the messaging. We need an immigration system that ensures British young people more jobs. Albania, Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, and Turkey are joining the EU. Mind your own business, Obama. Leaving the EU would ensure that we had better flood defences, that fluffy sheep, pictured, would have better lives, that the UK steel industry would be supported, remember Cummings' relish for geographical targeting, and that the shipping of whale meat through our ports would be stopped. On the 27th of March 2019, Dominic Cummings was ruled to be in contempt of Parliament after refusing to appear before MPs investigating fake news. The case had been referred to the House of Commons Committee of Privileges the previous June after Cummings failed to respond to an order of the House requiring him to give an undertaking to appear before the DCMS committee. Its report concluded that Cummings committed a contempt both by his initial refusal to obey the DCMS committee's order to attend and by his subsequent refusal to obey the House's order of the 7th of June. Committee Chair, the Conservative, Damian Collins, said Cummings had shown a total disregard for the authority of Parliament and called for statutory powers to reassert the authority that is missing. He added, "The Dominic Cummings case highlights the need for Parliament to define in law what its powers should be to require witnesses to attend hearings and what sanctions should apply if they do not." Significantly, many of the adverts scaremongering about the almost non-existent prospect of Turkey or Serbia joining the EU featured photographs of doctors or nurses looking glum, presumably at the prospect of having to treat their citizens. Indeed, it is almost impossible to separate the NHS messaging from the immigration provocations. This can't be a coincidence, but in another hint at the internal conflict he feels at winning dirty, Cummings was desperate with the Nudstock speech to see the two issues separately. So why did this happen, he asks. Was it just immigration? No, it wasn't just immigration. If it wasn't for the £350 million and turning the campaign, giving people a chance to vote for the NHS as well as voting against the EU, without that, then the economic scares of the establishment would have been too powerful and we would have lost. Could we have won without immigration? Absolutely not. I found the next bit of the speech quite disturbing. It took me a moment to realise that he was referring to the assassination of Joe Cox by a white supremacist terrorist, just as the anti-immigrant rhetoric of both Leave campaigns reached fever pitch. There may be another explanation, but it seems fair to presume that his apparent inability to say her name came from the same place as Paul Dacre's decision to report the sentencing of her murderer on page 30 of his newspaper, namely, shame. Referring to the establishment, he explains, they lived in the bubble, and you could see that in the last 10 days. After the terrible murder, they ditched their whole campaign, stopped talking about economic risks, and turned the whole thing into, well, we're the good people and you're the bad people, because that was the self-reinforcing culture that you heard in London, and Cameron and Osborne were psyched out by that, whereas in fact, as soon as you went outside the M25 and did the market research, the rest of the country had a totally different reaction to the murder than better-educated, richer people living in London did, and our campaign took advantage of it. The loudest, indeed only, cheer of the afternoon came when an audience member asked Cummings whether he ever felt guilty about what you've done. His answer is fascinating, as much for its insight into his epic fallibility as his thinking. No, not in the slightest, he said. The single most important reason for why I wanted to get out of the EU is it will drain the poison out of a lot of political debates. I predicted that if we get out, UKIP and Nigel Farage would be finished. That's an early gain for Vote Leave. As you can see, that's happened. That whole side of British politics will go. Once there's democratic control of immigration policy, immigration will go back to being a second or third order issue, and that will be a positive and healthy thing for the country. Bless him. 2 years later, Farage's rebranded Brexit Party not only won the European elections, but also struck a general election pact with Boris Johnson, senior adviser D. Cummings, and stood down 317 candidates in constituencies where a split vote would have aided Labour. Nevertheless, 2 years after that, Cummings was still celebrating. Obviously, I think Brexit was a good thing, he told, who else, the BBC's Laura Koonsberg. I think that the way in which the world has worked out since 2016 vindicates the arguments that Vote Leave made in all sorts of ways. I think it's good that Brexit happened. And 2 years after that, as we have seen, the Conservative government's attitude to immigration and refugees bore more resemblance to 1930s Germany than the post-Brexit United Kingdom of Cummings's fond imaginings. That, at least, was the expressed opinion of Holocaust survivor Joan Salter when she begged Suella Braverman, promoted far beyond her limited capabilities by Boris Johnson, to moderate her language. Cummings has had wobbles, most obviously in a 2017 Twitter exchange with David Alan Green. Green, a brilliant legal commentator who once worked alongside Daniel Hannan in the office of veteran Eurosceptic Bill Cash, asked Cummings, "Is there anything which could now happen or not happen which would make you now wish Leave had not won the referendum result?" Cummings replied, "Lots. I said before, ref was dumb idea, other things should have been tried first. In some possible branches of the future, leaving will be an error." We do not know whether Dominic Cummings considers the current situation to represent one of the branches of the future in which leaving the EU has been rendered an error. Certainly his predictions of what it would entail have come to naught, and his main reason for wanting it has not been realised. But the satisfaction of getting one over on the establishment, of which he insists that he, senior adviser to not one but two Tory leaders, spectator employee, think tank founder, airline entrepreneur and son-in-law of a baronet, is most definitely not a part, will probably sustain him well into old age. We do know, however, that his second greatest contribution to the breaking of Britain, the installation of Boris Johnson in Downing Street, will haunt him to his dying day. And so it should. On the 26th of May 2021, a joint hearing of the Science and Technology Committee and Health and Social Care Committee was investigating the government's response to the COVID-19 crisis. A cowed Cummings, who had departed Downing Street in acrimony the previous November, told them, "The truth is that senior ministers, senior officials, senior advisers like me fell disastrously short of the standards that the public has a right to expect of its government in a crisis like this. When the public needed us most, the government failed. I would like to say to all the families of those who died unnecessarily how sorry I am for the mistakes that were made and for my own mistakes at that." Dominic Cummings was finally telling the truth. Chapter 9. Boris Johnson. I have a hunch that Johnson will come to regret securing the prize for which he has struggled so long, because the experience of the premiership will lay bare his absolute unfitness for it. Former boss, Max Hastings. Tens of thousands of people died who didn't need to die. Former senior adviser, Dominic Cummings. On the 26th of May 2021, Dominic Cummings appeared before the Joint Science and Technology Committee and Health and Social Care Committee inquiry in the House of Commons. The air of wide-eyed mania remained, but gone was the arrogant disdain of his previous Brexit-related testimonies. Instead, the man who had always displayed unleavened contempt for MPs daring to interrogate him appeared contrite, reflective, and even, in perhaps the least convincing element of the often surreal session, almost modest. "It is completely crazy that I should have been in such a senior position, in my personal opinion," he said of his role at Boris Johnson's side when the COVID-19 crisis began. "I'm not smart, I've not built great things in the world, it's just completely crackers that someone like me should have been in there, just the same as it's crackers that Boris Johnson was in there." Leaving aside the obvious fact that nobody had forced the self-confessed inadequate to take the job, the speed with which scales had apparently fallen from eyes was notable. 5 years after the referendum divorced British politics from observable reality for at least a generation, and, we learned, just 1 year after that result had helped Johnson to a historic majority, the person who had perhaps done more than any other to secure both dismal outcomes was suddenly, bitterly regretful. This public self-flagellation must be taken with a cellar full of salt. Cummings had essentially been thrown out of Number 10 in November 2020 after losing a power struggle with the Prime Minister's then-fiancée, Carrie Symons. He was photographed carrying a cardboard box out of the Downing Street door in the week when the official COVID-19 death toll passed the 50,000 milestone, and yet office vendettas and fights for Johnson's ear were still, apparently, paramount concerns inside. In front of the inquiry, Cummings threw around apologies like confetti and portrayed Johnson's leadership until that point as a picture of almost criminal negligence. Yet he was silent about his own part in such pettiness. Indeed, it was hard throughout his 8 hours of testimony to separate the boundless bitterness from the professed desire to set the record straight. Symons and her husband were not the only people with whom he appeared desperate to settle old scores. The hapless Health Secretary Matt Hancock came in for frequent, well-deserved kickings. Most of the Downing Street staff, cabinet members, fellow Cobra meeting attendees, and even Dylan, the Johnson's dog, were in the firing line too. The castigation of Boris Johnson, however, remains by far the most significant element of his evidence. This partly for obvious reasons, because of the urgency of all inquiries into the government's handling of COVID-19, but especially for our purposes, because Cummings became an unwitting exemplar that day of all the people who had laboured under the lethal illusion that the depravity of Boris Johnson should be allowed anywhere near Downing Street. That the electorate could end up letting him was due to the work of every other chapter dedicatee in this book, except perhaps Jeremy Corbyn, who simply failed to oppose him, most of the rest of the British media, and, by the end of 2019, almost the entire Conservative Party. Johnson will star in many stories, some already written. In this one, he is relevant for just two reasons. First, he is living, lying proof of just what can rise to the top when the subversion of the media political ecosystem described here has come close to critical mass. He has shown us all exactly what can happen when newspaper editors and proprietors abnegate any responsibility to hold politicians to account. He has shown us what will rise when the BBC is compromised by political appointments, cowed by negative outside coverage, and reserves its richest rewards for journalists committed to cultivating the likes of Cummings, who revealed to that select committee that the main journalist he briefed in the early weeks of COVID-19 was Laura Koonsberg, Matthew Elliott, and Boris Johnson. And he has shown us what will prosper when a favoured politician's previously honourable colleagues sacrifice their integrity on the altar of personal ambition. To understand what Johnson was known to be long before he became Prime Minister is to understand the rotted core of a country in which such a calamity could come to pass. Second, a catalogue of the catastrophe and moral corruption he brought into government and then proceeded to inflict upon the country will highlight how completely the checks and balances of Parliament and the Fourth Estate were rendered redundant by complicity and contempt. When someone truly believes themselves to be above the petty requirements of decency and honesty, they will triumph only if other people condone, collude, or look the other way. It is well documented that Johnson's housemaster at Eton identified precisely this personality defect early in his life. I think he honestly believes that it is churlish of us not to regard him as an exception, wrote Martin Hammond to Johnson's father Stanley in April 1982, one who should be free of the network of obligation that binds everyone else. Less well known is a letter written by another former Eton teacher and published in The Times on the 13th of June 2023. John Claughton, master from 1984 to 2001, wrote, "Whatever wider attitude Eton adopts, the school itself will continue to educate the global elite. Perhaps its most important mission will be to ensure that its pupils are saved from the sense of privilege, entitlement and omniscience that can produce alumni such as Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Kwasi Kwarteng and Ben Elliott, and thereby damage a country's very fabric. Sadly, I failed in that purpose." It is important to record not only how Johnson and his accomplices damaged the country's very fabric, but also how he could ever have ended up in a position where he could do so. He illustrates almost perfectly both what had happened to Britain to allow him to become Prime Minister and what could happen as a consequence of promoting such an irredeemable charlatan. My probably naive hope here is simply to collate a mound of publicly available evidence in the hope that people will wonder how on earth they could ever have tolerated, never mind supported, Boris Johnson. Peter Oborne has already undertaken the task in much greater detail in his 2021 volume, The Assault on Truth. The entire book, which should be required reading for any political journalist or, for that matter, voter, is dedicated to Johnson's lies and their corrosive effect on society. Here, the serial mendacity and moral turpitude are just one crucial piece of a larger jigsaw, and while I may be throwing stones, I am not without sin. My own scales from eyes moment came shortly after I foolishly voted for him in the 2008 London mayoral election, partly due to his raising the prospect of an amnesty for foreign-born people working here illegally. It quickly became clear that, contrary to a specific election pledge, he would soon be presiding over the closure of fire stations and cuts to the fire service. My awakening was rude. In 2013, the Labour leader on the London Assembly, Andrew Dismore, would ask the then mayor about his plans. "How can cutting fire stations, cutting fire engines, and cutting firefighters' posts not be a reduction in fire cover? You've lied to the people of London." Johnson's reply was as brief, arrogant, and obnoxious as his future term as Prime Minister. "Get stuffed," he barked. After Eton, Oxford. The public mythology is well documented. President of the Union, Bullingdon Club member, tireless self-promoter, student journalist, and betrothal to Allegra Mostyn Owen, a landowner's daughter who had already graced the cover of Tatler magazine. Johnson, hilariously, turned up with neither trousers nor shoes. By the time of their divorce, 6 years later, Johnson's mistress and future second wife, Marina Wheeler, was already pregnant with their first child. In December 2019, a writer and healthcare worker called Damien Furness wrote a Facebook post recalling his time at Oxford when Johnson and David Cameron were also students. He is warm about the latter, not least because even when I sabotaged his college beagle pack, he took it in good humour. But his memories of Johnson are of an entirely different flavour. "I have different memories of Alexander Boris the Pheffel Johnson, who was the first Oxford student I met when I was at Balliol College for interview in 1984. I was a rural working-class kid with a stammer from a state school which hadn't prepared me for the experience, but I was bright and well-read, with more interest in and knowledge of my subjects of philosophy, politics and economics than most of my public school rivals could muster. My session